Hi, welcome back to the Pleasure Project with Dr. Jen Kennedy. In this episode, I interview Dr. Sada Nazrizadeh, who is a globally renowned author, speaker, and thinking partner. She has a new book out called Love by Design. And in this episode, we really go through the elements of her ideas. This is for longer term couples who've been together and who want more than just the expectation that the spontaneous feeling of desire is going to always stay. Instead, she's really broken it down into these key elements of emergent love that I think are just so smart. They're smart, they make a lot of sense. I think they're really practical. We also just talked through some general observations that she's made in her research and in her time with couples. And we look at like the difference between a pleasure versus a comfort relationship. We look at the gold versus the platinum rule. So these are all things you're going to get in this episode. So tune in and I look forward to your feedback. Okay, so welcome back and hello to my guest today, Sada Nazaraha. Did I say that right?
Sara Nasirzadeh.
Nasrzadeh. Okay. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Really glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And so let me give you a little bit of history on her. Building world peace, one relationship at a time, is the mission of Dr. Nasrzadeh, a globally renowned author, speaker, and thinking partner. With a PhD in social psychology and a specialization in the fields of human sexuality and relationships, she has worked with thousands of individuals, couples, and organizational clients to enhance relational health and a sense of thriving at both macro and micro levels. She has been sought after cultural advisor, speaker, and expert facilitator at high profile events hosted by governmental organizations, United Nations agencies, academic institutions, and Fortune 500 companies. Her third book, Love by Design, Six Ingredients to Build a Lifetime of Love, is the result of her two-decade-long research on the status of thriving relationships and its key ingredients, namely attraction, respect, trust, shared vision, compassion, and loving behaviors. Dr. Nasrzadeh, whose work has been featured on NPR, the BBC, ABC, CNN, and USA Today, is based in Los Angeles. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, your book came to my attention on a mutual listserv, and I was intrigued. I love anything that can help couples. And so this was a really interesting take. And I appreciated your bio. So I wanted you to give us a little bit about your history that brought you to this place to write this type of book.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. It's really lovely to be in conversation with colleagues because as we are talking, you really appreciate how much we didn't have, how much pain we sat with day in, day out.
Yeah.
Just, couples come. Okay, so now I understand this concept. Where do I go from here? So that was one of the reasons that I tried to go beyond my anecdotal observations of practice that I had with couples. And really put it into research to be able to generalize it to at least majority of couples out there, and also try to bring fresh perspective in something that hasn't been questioned for really ever since the whole model of becoming submerged with somebody came to be the reality of what we know and what we abide by, what we chase, what we are aspiring to. So I wanted to tell people how we got here so that we can really deconstruct love in a way, and then have evidence-informed ingredients to show them where to put your efforts, where they actually matter. It goes somewhere, right? And then at the end, I wanted them to know how it feels. How do you assess whether you are in this relationship or not? Just don't leave it to guesses. Guesses don't go well with me in life in general. I want everything to be intentional as best as I can.
And I appreciate the research because, like you said, we sit with clients and we start to develop theories about this, but it's nice to actually have the research to back it up and to inform how we work. And also the international perspective, right? You're not just hyper-focused, you're based here now, but you've lived and you've worked in different cultures and different languages even. And that helps inform a larger perspective with, you know, with the approach to this, and not just the given that we're supposed to have this one way of coming together that's so explosive and magical that's supposed to last our lifetime.
Yes, and also, you know, majority of research, if you really look at it, besides the Gottman's research that was done with actual couples, long-term, short-term couples, they actually observed them. Majority of research go with populations that are actually very easily accessible. So it's either college students or people who are prior to getting committed to the next level, let's say, for example, premarital consultations, you know, they go for premarital consultations and then they are asked a few questions. What I wanted to do was to give people an idea, what does it take to thrive in a relationship? Not why they fail, but why they thrive. So that was the main difference that I wanted to bring to the table. And yeah, the research aspect of it is very important to me because everybody has an opinion, and all of us working behind the closed doors with humans, we need to have high level of creativity to do that. But then that doesn't mean that, as brilliant as our work is, it doesn't mean that that's generalizable. Mm-hmm. That could be something that could be used from this couple to the other. So just bringing it all together, I think, for colleagues as well as for couples out there, yeah, I'm hoping that I've done a good job to create that for mm-hmm. them.
Well, and it's also the idea, because much of the books out there, the writings out there are focused on the problems mm-hmm. instead of looking at what works, and then more the solution-oriented approach. So you said a couple of things in here. Well, I'm going to quote you throughout this because I think you've just said a lot of really helpful, insightful things. Couples are often alone together and that they expect too much from one another. Can you talk about that?
Sure. If I can break it into two, one of the things that, tell me if you see that in your couples as well. One of the things that I see is couples come together and because of job or any other situation, they move a lot. So we are not really close to the village that we are coming from. So there's not an assumed relative network. There's not an assumed group of colleagues that we connect with. So we just work, and then go home. And then we go to that special someone. And we expect that they hold us, they nurture us, they excite us, and everything that in between. One of the issues that I see is a lot of my couples, they are very lonely. So when I ask them, do you socialize? Like, what is the social aspect of your life? They are so bubbled up with each other mm-hmm. that they don't really get any outputs, you know, mm-hmm. like polish themselves. And also they don't get any inputs from outside, for example. The fact that, and that was very highlighted during the pandemic, a lot of people find that, oh, maybe I'm not attracted to my partner. Oh, they're so boring. And then when we really started to discuss it, because they didn't see, you know how you go outside to a party or something and somebody looks at your partner, you're like, oh, I've got the good one. Mm-hmm. So from other people's gaze, approvals almost, and we are human. This is not something to be ashamed of. This comes with us. We want to know where we fit. This is based on very intuitive sense that we have of we would like to compare ourselves with other people. Do I fit? Where do you fit? So when we lost those gazes on our partners and where we fit in the society, we started questioning that, ooh, what are the points of attraction here? That's a big one. So when I see people who are alone together, these are the people who maybe they're new in the city, or maybe they're just really cuddled up in their own circle, in their own bubble. So again, they have no point of reflection.
Well, and also that familiarity, I think initially we see the exterior of our partner, right? That's one of the main attractors for most folks is what is the physical package. But once you've been together a couple of years, it's so much about essence, right? It's so much about the person. And certainly during the pandemic, when people were trapped for years. I found that either the couples came together and really like found sort of deeper, more meaningful versions of one another, or they blew apart. They just couldn't, you know, they were just so like different or disinterested or unwilling to kind of do that next level work. Yeah.
And also some of them, as you mentioned, they found those deeper connection and appreciation that, oh my God, where would I be without this person to quarantine with? And then they saw a lot of compassion, understanding the way, you know, some of the examples that I brought to the in the book, they were real. Like some people heard their partner managing a very stressful situation at work and they grew in their respect for them. Or other way around, they realized that, oh my God, is this the way that you treat your coworkers or people on the other side of the line or whatever? Oh my God, who am I living with? Or some of them got to see for the first time up close how the other person parents. And that was absolutely unacceptable or endearing for them. So, and I know that we're talking in polarities and there are nuances here, but these are the things that we hear day in, day out, like in our practices during the pandemic.
Yep, I think it's true. The other thing that I thought was really interesting that you highlighted was the, like, the question of choice. You know, in our culture, in the United States, we're not used to arranged marriages. We're not used to, in fact, we're used to like having lots of choice, and online dating has blown that up. And the divorce rate reflects people want to keep choosing, and sort of that idea, like, do we have too much choice, and what does that do to the psyche of choosing a longer term partner?
Yes, research shows that the more choices you have, the more dissatisfied you are. That's a fact. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple very good, well-conducted research in that. But let's go back to maybe arranged marriages, because I feel like, you know, it's really interesting because of where I'm coming from originally. Many people even looked at this when I said love by design. They're like, she's going to just make us have arranged marriages. No, that's not what I'm about. When you look at the book, you will see that, you know, the range that I'm offering. And in fact, a lot of people who got a lot of validation from the book were people who are non-binary, who are not in the cisgender heterosexual model of loving relationship that we are abiding by. But what I would like people to know is that you have choice. You have some choices here. And this choice is different than paradox of choice. Paradox of choice talks about how many options I have or assumed options I have. And it's linked to the fact of FOMO, fear of missing out, that, oh my God, if I commit to this person, then what about that person? How many clients have I had in the past 20 years? They've been living together. They had kids together, 7 years, you know, whatever. And then when they wanted to commit to each other further, maybe they wanted to get married, move somewhere together, or whatnot. And they came to me and said, well, is this the right person? Like, have you been living with this person for all these years?
Right. They're still doing that like negotiation in their own mind. Yeah. Isn't that incredible? Definitely.
So the FOMO in the culture, I would say FOMO is socially constructed for all of us with the choices, with everything. I see it in my 10-year-old. You know, if I choose this shoe, mommy, but maybe online I can find 11 more. So it's a very interesting life that we are living, and we have never had to face this before. And also with arranged marriages, they have anchoring points. So arranged marriages are a spectrum, right? They are on a spectrum. One is, which is still possible in some rural areas in the world that I've seen, that people don't even see each other. The bigger circle of the social context pick them. They come together based on different compatibilities, maybe transactional elements in the families or tribes, or, you know, marriage is not about the two people. Two people are going to make the bonds. So that's one. But it's becoming rare and more rare these days, or maybe in English you say rare these days. And then, but then all the way to, I was all about, I am going to arrange my own marriage, because I was thinking, you know, there must be intentional. I'm highly spiritual. I believe in faith. I believe in all of that. But on the other side of it, also, I believe in science and evidence that if I know the laws of attraction, if I know myself very well, what is going to be fulfilling for me at my essence, based on my own essence, then I could go after somebody who is not at least opposing those, which is a lot of my couples.
And that feeling of like having to get exactly right, having to find the perfect person, instead of like that framing that you just sort of introduced of building the relationship, right? Building the perfect relationship, and having it also understood that it's not static, right? This is a dynamic thing that will happen for many years to come. And both partners have, or all the partners involved have, influence over that.
Sure. And you know, this whole idea of perfect optimization, maximization. So this is also a huge part of our culture in the United States. And I know that it will serve us in majority of places that we go, you know, like talking from my corporate background, for example, that was very helpful for us to optimize, be efficient, all that. But when it comes to human relationships, it's there are lots of nuances and we all evolve. So what I would love to replace optimization and perfectionism in a relationship sphere is fulfillment. When we have fulfillment, then we will react to the situations very, very differently, or even better, we are responsive than reactive in certain situations that could be even triggering for us. So again, you know, my hope is with our discourses, we are going to introduce new terminology because language defines how we conceptualize things. So if we can really define these words a little bit differently, just tweak it a little bit differently to be more accurate to what we expect of our relationships to be and align them what we desire, I think we are in better shape.
I agree. I hear couples often coming in with the complaint of like how they feel. And what I appreciated too is that you are more action oriented, right? That there's things you can do versus just lean back on how you feel. Because that falling out of love is something that I certainly as a sex therapist hear a lot. But in general, as a couples therapist comes up, and it's like that constant pursuit of in love, which often, you know, goes back to that first period, instead of understanding what are you doing in relationship? How does that factor in?
But the reason action is very important is if we go again to the science of who we are as humans, what are intuitive to us? What are the basic needs that we have? One of the basic needs that we have is a sense of agency. If you take that away from any circumstances, the fulfillment level goes really low. So that's one of the reasons that I feel like, you know, actions are very important.
Yeah. Yep. That makes sense. Because if you feel if there's no agency, then you feel powerless. And then you sort of just feel like you have to take what you get instead of actively participating in the partnership or the movement of the dynamic.
Yes, and depending on depending on your predispositions, you might feel like a victim, you might feel smothered, you might feel like you have to punch the other person to get your space back, you might want to, so it's like a passive aggressive, resentment, all of those come from that, if you feel like you don't have a sense of agency.
Right. Yep. So you talk about also desire and attraction, and how desire is typically fleeting, which is again that like 6 months to 2 year kind of, you know, limerence time in early pairing. But you call attraction a renewable resource, which I love. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So again, with every concept that we bring up, because this is so novel, I need to kind of have a disclaimer first and then describe what the research showed. So with desire, I would like people to think about the food that they like, right? Today I wake up and I desire that breakfast over the other. It depends on my mood, my hormone levels, my whatever. Last night, did I sleep well or not? Or do I feel like I have cellulite or not? You know, so it depends on a lot of superficial.
Fleeting,
fleeting mood or sensations or emotions. But when we talk about attraction, attraction is what I want to be around. So if I'm attracted to you today, I can't just come tomorrow and say that, you know what, I'm not attracted anymore. Why? Because attraction grows with how much I get to know you and know myself. So the way that I see it is, if two people come together, imagine that this is like a two people relationship, right? And this applies to corporate, to any relationship, any setting that I've been in, at least. They come together, there's a reason you have an attraction to this person, right? It could be social, it could be financial, it could be they are far from what you know, it could be very familiar to what you know, it could be by proximity. Every day I go take the tube, we are in the US, take it the metro.
The subway.
The subway. And then I bump into this guy that is going to work at the same time. And we exchange some gazes, you know? So that proximity, that familiarity, that exposure factor, these are all backed up by science, that, you know, by human science experiments. They will create something in you, some sense of, oh, you know, I want to be around this person. I want to get to know them a little bit more. And sometimes also it's physical attraction and sexual attraction that brings people together, which is wonderful. My idea and the way that our research depicts this is it can't be the only point of attraction, right? The sexual attraction. Because going back to the research that was quoted in the book and you just mentioned, there are two or three really solid research around this that talks about that point of infatuation that you really, really can't get your hands off of each other, that will fizzle out as you become more familiarized and physically you are more in tune with one another. It's like over a period of years, you're tickling yourself. It's that feeling, neurophysiological response to it is that, right? So that can't be sustained. And for people who have it for a longer time, wonderful for you, but this is the majority of people that have been, you know, participating in this research. Now, I mean, my other colleagues' research, right? So one of the things that people need to realize to create attraction beyond that point that brought you together, you need to keep growing as yourself, like what is my essence, what am I doing, and where am I going in life? So get to know yourself. Into me, I see, and then I'm going to open up to you. I invite you to see those parts that I want you to see, I want to bring and share in this relationship, to be celebrated, to be nurtured in this relationship, and have the capacity from the other side to do that individually, and then bring it into this space too. So basically, if attraction goes into, develops into me I see and into me you see, attraction to intimacy, then that is a healthy growth that is happening and the attraction remains because both of you are growing. Now, one of the things that I see a lot in my couples is one of them stopped. They are stagnant or they drift apart because of that interpersonal dynamics that probably we'll talk about later. So these are the things that I would like people to know when they think about desire. Do I have desire? Am I talking about is desire? And I want to add even something else here. Arousal. Arousal is a different thing also altogether. Mm-hmm. And, you know, attraction and intimacy. So these are the words that if we can really conceptualize them, define them, and know what we mean by each of them, we are more literate in the way that we enter our relational spaces.
And the curiosity of kind of that can fuel the ongoing attraction, right? That we're not static, steady beings, that we're dynamic, and that ongoing curiosity can help feed sort of a longer term, you know, renewal of that attraction feeling.
Sure. So curiosity and genuine interest, there are two concepts that, again, I would like for people to take away from this part of our conversation. Curiosity has a hint of ignorance. So I put myself in a place that I come with curiosity. Like, I want to know more. I want to get to know you. Also, we need to have genuine interest. over a period of time. Because in a loving, long-term relationship, curiosity cannot be the go-to all the time. Because sometimes by this time, you really need to know that I'm really not a fan of broccoli. So there's nothing curious about it. You should know that and you should pay attention. But if we only abide by curiosity, then we might actually end up offending the other person because it feels like, oh, well, you should know this by now. Mm-hmm. I'm not leaving it to assuming and guessing, but it would be.
Yeah.
Right.
It's kind of that idea that don't assume that you ever really fully know somebody, right? Mm-hmm. That there's dimensions of them, there's because they're changing and they've got history that you weren't a part of. And so that's more like the curiosity of like, you know, continue to be curious about them, be interested in them. Yeah. So maybe semantics, but so you differentiate between emergent love, which is really your hallmark, versus submergent. And I think that's a really critical concept that we're sort of walking into. So maybe talk about those two.
Sure. So submergent love is the model that many of us grew up with. So 1 + 1 mm-hmm. equals one. One day you're going to meet somebody, your person, you're going to spend a lot of resources, time, energy, money, and attention with them, for them, and together, and then you become one. So you go down, even the language we use, we fall into it. We go down together, mm-hmm. one, right? And then from there, we need to spend the rest of our lives to come out of it. So the way that I see my couples. But emergent love is 1 + 1 = 3. Imagine that spark and log coming together in a conducive context. What you have is a cozy, warm fire. If you take any of them away, fire dies. But as long as these two are there with the good quality, required qualities, which are the 6 ingredients in the book, then you're going to have the fire burning and mm-hmm. refueling you for as long as you want.
Mm-hmm. So tell us the ingredients.
Sure. Attraction. What brings the two of you together? What do you want to be around? And respect. A big part of respect is boundaries. Are you respectable? Are you able to hold your boundaries lovingly and firmly without being passive aggressive and asking for your space all the time and chucking other people, like, you know, punching other people out? And putting priorities in the places that matter in the relationship, you know, showing up with respect for yourself and everybody involved. Trust. Two components of trust are consistency and reliability. And again, I don't leave these big concepts to people to define. I want them to have one sentence to define each of them to see if it resonates and abide by them. And I have tons of exercises, as you pointed out in the book. So I covered 3 so far. And then shared vision. Where are you committed to go together, even when you don't feel like it? That's important. Big part of it. Commitment is a big part of it. What are you committing to? It's not just to the other person, to yourself. A lot of people come to me with issues of bridging of trust and commitment, and they make it about the other person. So what do you want me to do? How can I regain your trust? And then I look at them and say, well, what do you want to do? What are you committing to as a person?
Mm-hmm.
And I never forget when we met with my husband, we were dating. And I told him, look, I'm not one of those people who says, don't do this, don't do that. No, no. Do you respect yourself enough to respect the choice you made? If you ever mm-hmm. feel like you change your mind, I would like to know, please. And looking back, I'm thinking, wow, that was interesting that I came up with that.
Right. Like you're really handing it to him and saying, okay, you're the monitor of yourself.
Yeah, because, you know, you can't really put a leash on somebody. And some of my couples do that. You know, grown people, we need to take accountability, responsibilities. And the other thing is when we talk about trust, people immediately go to infidelity and having sex with somebody else. But trust could be social, could be financial, mm-hmm. could be so many different things, you know, spiritual even. So that's trust. The other, and shared vision and trust. And then the other one is compassion. And the last but not least is being loving. So with the loving, being loving, my editor asked me, the whole book is about love. Why do you need a whole chapter on it? I said, look, being loving in our research showed up with different quality, like that tenderness in words, in touch. That's almost exclusivity, making the other person special. It's not about exclusivity of the boundaries of the, you know, couple them, because with agreement, you can do anything you want. But it's important for people to know that there's that special quality. I go out of my way for you. I give you benefit of the doubt that I don't really necessarily give to other people. So I know certain things about you that other people don't. So these are the elements that make a touch, a word, being around each other more towards loving. And for compassion also, compassion is being there for the other without making it about ourselves.
Yeah, I like what you were saying too about being loving, because it's giving the other person grace. It's knowing them well enough to understand when they maybe need a little more consideration. And that can be sexually, that can be socially, that can be, you know, with family. That's in all different circumstances, knowing enough to sort of, you know, be supportive, or, you know, be show up in the way that is meaningful to them.
Yeah, that's why I call these ingredients, because in different phases of life, different seasons of a couple of them, different day even, we might need to sprinkle a little bit more of this or a little more of that. So that's why I call them ingredients, so that nothing is set in stone.
Well, and I like too that you offer an assessment, so that if couples are wondering kind of how they're doing in these various areas, you know, there's a research-based assessment that you can do to sort of see what's a snapshot, and then your therapist can work with you to, you know, to strengthen some of these areas if they're not strong.
Yeah, relationship panoramic inventory. It takes about 30, 40 minutes to complete. Both people take it separately. And if people are in consensual non-monogamous relationships, they can take it two people at a time, because this is a dyad analysis. And then it will highlight a lot of things, like your thinking style, temperament, connection style, respect, trust, you know. So it has the individual fundamental aspect. What do you bring to the relationship? How are you doing? And then it gives you an idea about the interpersonal dynamic of the six ingredients. How are you perceiving them? How are you receiving them? How are you expressing them? Are they being experienced by the other person the way that you meant to?
Yeah.
So that's piece of it. And then it's going to show you also the overall fit of the relationship, the overall satisfaction. And it has more than 12 individually validated scales for colleagues who are out there and want to know if they can trust the inventory or not. So
super helpful, just to because we all have a gut feeling about what's going on, but really seeing the bigger picture and then being able to operationalize how do we make it better. I think I'll definitely be using that with my couples.
That's lovely. You know, the other thing I want to say is two things. Going back to the sense of agency, one is, this is the only test for couples that it's not diagnostic, it's not prognostic, it's not pathology based, it's not like an intake. So when you see the report, you will see that it's about 28 pages of, you know, like everything, but the couple go hand in hand. So they see where each fit. Let's say, for example, one person has trust for their partner, but doesn't feel trusted. You can see it there and then. And we also included the average couple there. So our couples get to see where they fit. Because sometimes also abiding by that perfectionism and, you know, all that, they're doing horribly wrong, you know, in certain areas. And then when they see that, it's so affirming for them. Actually, we're doing okay. We're good.
Right. Again, it's that comparison of like, wait, where are we in the scheme of, you know, the larger picture? I think that's useful.
And they can also go online and take it under themselves. If both of them consent, they receive the report themselves. But if they want to sit with another person, they can enter the provider's name, and the provider receives it, sits with them, and go through them. It's a strength based rather than pathology based.
Right. I like that. I think it's because a lot of couples are doing okay, but they'd like to do better. And I feel like that's that's a really helpful tool for that.
I hope so. Dr. Jen, one of the things that I'm hoping with RPI, with the Relationship Panoramic Inventory, remember for how many years many of us said, wouldn't that be nice if couples come to us before they are ready to kill each other?
Right.
You know, because it takes us,
Right. They wait too long.
They wait too long. So I wanted to create something that happy couples can use. You know, my husband and I take it once a year. And and every year we come up with some ideas. Ooh, I didn't know that. You know, so there are little things that you need to put more intention behind. Every year is different. It's a relationship. It's like a 360-degree review that we do in corporate companies everywhere. So how about in the
relationship? Yeah, makes sense. That's a great idea. And I like that returning to it too, to just sort of have some objective data about how your level of, because right, we have this general feeling like my couples don't want to kill each other. Most of the time they come to me and they're disengaged. They sort of feel blah. They feel like, meh, like what, you know, what do we have here? So I think being able to articulate what those areas are is going to be helpful. Let's see. Okay, I've got a couple more questions. We're moving into some of the sex stuff because that's tends to be more my listeners' interest. So you talk about sex playing many roles in the coupleship. Can you talk about some of those?
So one of the first questions I ask anybody who comes to me, individual couple, I ask them, what is the meaning of sex in your life and what is the role of sex? Look, I've heard so many different things, and majority of times I do this in individual sessions, even if I see them as a couple, because sometimes it's not very easy for a person to say that, look, I have sex with my partner to make sure that I keep a tranquil household, because I feel like it stabilizes the energy in the house. Another person says, I do this to get that. Another person says, I feel close. Another person says, isn't this that the husband and wife supposed to do? So different meanings, different roles. Meanings is what is the meaning for you personally, what do you get out of it? And role is how are you going to manage in the relational space? Like, what is the role of sex in the management of the relational space? So what is it in relation to other people involved? So that's how I define it.
I would also say too, is that those different, I ask the question more like, what is the function of sex? Which maybe is a little researchery for me, but it's because it does matter. And I will say the same person might have a different answer at different times in their lives, right? Sometimes it is just because it's a stress relief, and sometimes it's a connection, and sometimes it's to make the partner feel happy, you know? It's a relational maintenance.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the example.
All normal.
Yeah, sure. Like one of the examples I brought in the book, a couple came to me, and one of them was absolutely disgusted by the other person. And as we got to it, to this role and meaning of sex, they just buried the person's father. One of them lost their father. And then as soon as they came home from the burial service, the other person initiated sex. And the person said, you just lost your father. What kind of an animal are you? What that partner didn't understand before this conversation that we had was, it was so painful for the other person to lose their father, to feel like become so close to death that they wanted to claim their aliveness. I'm alive. I deserve this pleasure and I feel connected. I can still do this. So as soon as they had this conversation, it was like, cold water and hot.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's the context, right? It gives more context to the why, which helps soften and connect the two. That makes sense. So you talk about sexual harmony. That's another like new phrase that I'm picking up from this, instead of just chemistry. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Sure. So sexual chemistry and sexual harmony, if we go out of the realm of relationships and think physics and chemistry that we studied in third grade, fourth grade. I don't know at what age you did it in the US. In Tehran.
Not third grade, but
Third grade. So the volcanic explosion on third grade for us. We brought the chemicals together, and then you know, all the alchemists and everything, and then it exploded, beautiful colors, everything, and then it fizzled out. No matter how much more we added baking soda or whatever that we had, it didn't reignite or rekindled or none of that. That is, you know, out there, the terminology that people use. So sexual chemistry is short-lived. It brings us together evolutionary-wise, if people believe in evolution. So we come together to make babies and that are genetically as healthy as possible. That's why we are attracted by sexual chemistry, right? And then we move forward. That could be affected by different medications that we take, different hormonal levels, different phases of life, all sorts of things, also sexual chemistry, because it's physiology based, right? But then on the other, and also it's evolutionary based. But on the other side of it, sexual harmony, as the name dictates, right? What it does is that we come together. It's like playing in an orchestra. You really need to have a very good listening power if you want to listen, if you want to be a part of a duet in a musical piece. You need to listen, attune, and this is one of those areas with sexual harmony that I think erotic empathy is very important. So you really allow your partner to regulate you, you regulate them. So this is important for people to know that sexual harmony is, as you keep evolving with each other, getting to know each other, getting to learn the language of body and physique, especially as we get older, our bodies changes, different seasons of life, phase of life, different interpretations of physical connection with one another. So I find that in my long-term couples who are thriving, sexual harmony has a way bigger role than sexual chemistry. So that's why
I love that harmony analogy is so poignant, because so much of sexual, really successful, I would say, sexual dynamics is nonverbal. It is, I mean, yes, there's some of the communication via talking, but so much of it's body language, eye contact, you know, like listening to someone as their body tells you if they're into it or what they want. And yeah, and so a duet is very much like that, right? They're not actually talking about what to do. You're listening and you're attuning and you're adjusting and you're, yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. Okay, so you also introduced an idea that I thought was really interesting about physical pain is registering in the brain, as does pleasure, but also that idea of like, we understand, and sometimes we say like, what do we want? And we expect a person to want what we want, but like the gold, you say the gold versus the platinum rule. We know the golden rule, I think most of us in this culture, but like, talk about kind of your modification to the platinum.
Sure. Yeah. So the golden rule is, as we majority of us grew up with, do to others as you would like to be done to you. That has merit, and that's beautiful. That's a baseline. But as we, as cultural beings, evolve in our societal context, the platinum rule goes something like this: do to others as they want you to do to them. So, for example, your child, your husband, your coworker, your boss, your, you know, whoever, your mother, your sibling in hierarchical relationships, they say, please don't call me at 2 o'clock. This is my nap time. But because this is your comfort zone, you keep calling them at 2 o'clock. You are breaching trust. You are walking all over yourself respect-wise, and you're disrespecting the other person and all the above. So platinum rule, I think, goes a long way when it comes to relationships. Again, it goes by genuine interest in listening to the other person. What is it that they want? And getting out of your own shell to think that, well, I want this to be done to me. Then I want, why can't you appreciate it?
And that comes into play sexually a lot, right? I like this thing, so I want you to like this thing. And instead of understanding, you know, that you don't have to be the same, but you have to be relational, and you have to ideally tune in and know what your partner likes and give them what they want.
Yes. And if I want to give people something practical to take away, I worked with people who changed over time. Let's say, for example, they got together. They felt like they were very sexually compatible in a sense that, let's say, for example, their level of kink level, pain seeking level, or pleasure seeking level, a lot of this, even mechanical, they were very compatible with one another. Over a period of time, they changed. One of them changed, both of them changed, you know, whatever. Or, and especially because everyday exposure matters. What I'm exposed to is going to change the wiring for me, for my erotic blueprint, right? Sure. Erotic, like what I want in the erotic space. And also the physical changes that we have. So over a period of time, couples come to us with, we are not sexually compatible. What I find is that if you really think about it from the emergent love perspective, 1 + 1 = 3, what I suggest to my couples, sometimes you need to do something that is good for this partner, and the measure is fulfillment. Mm-hmm. All I care about is that you are fulfilled, both of you, coming out of that. Maybe you're fulfilled because you could pleasure your partner. Maybe the other person is fulfilled because they could ask for what they want and get pleasured, right? So that's one. And then sometimes for the other person, as long as you also have that mutual ground with each other. There's an exercise in the book that I call sexy time. And I introduce people to sexy menu. There's a reason for that. Because what I find is people are looking for, again, submergent love. Remember 1 + 1 = 1? Mm-hmm. You need to be exactly aligned, as what gives me pleasure needs to give you pleasure. What gives me this, it needs to give you that too. So, or if I'm experiencing orgasm, you have to experience an orgasm. What are you talking about? And not even experiencing, you have to have or achieve orgasm. How many of those couples do you see, right? And it pains me to see them in pain because, you know, that needs a change of epistemology almost, you know, the way that they see the whole thing. So with those couples, I give you the analogy of restaurant. That's why sexy menu. Sexy time menu. I ask my couples to come up with a menu that is fulfilling to them. It could be anything that they like, foot drop, you know, like to all the way to kink, whatever that their thing is, right? And then the other person too. And then you come together, you're like, and then in a mutual situation, you're like, you know what, tonight we're going to have a sexy time. Can I have item 7? And then item 7 is a 7-course meal, right? The other says, I might not be hungry. Can I have a biscuit and tea, item 3? As long as you go to the situation, know what is happening, and coming out of it fulfilled, I'm good with that. And that will contribute to sexual harmony. Rather than when we go to this space, it has to be spontaneous. It has to, you know, both people need to experience the same thing. And, you know, that is, I'll tell you people, this is not how it works.
And if you come to the party with the same expectations that it's going to look like, I mean, that starts to get boring too. So I like the idea of the menu because there is, first of all, just creating that. I've done something sort of along that line with couples before, and I think they really get into it. They like the idea. Now, if of course they have to agree on multiple items that are available for selection, but yeah, I think it gives them some language for that. So.
Yeah, so while we're on language, if I can just sprinkle something last minute. I also would like couples not to talk with their regular language with one another when they are in a sexual scenario. So again, going back to neurotransmitters, going back to neuroresonance that we have. If I just tell you, let's give an experiment here, Dr. Jen, right? If I say, in karo nakon, man kheli dus nadara. Did it evoke any emotion in you?
It was flat.
Flat.
It was kind of flat.
But if I say, if you ever do that again, I would not sleep with you.
Mm-hmm.
Or for example, don't do this. I really don't like it. Right? So each of those communicate with a certain neurotransmitter, right? Neuroresonance. Creates a neuroresonance. Language is that. So when they are in that scenario, I recommend to people who agree upon some words, and there are equivalent to the red and amber and green light of
Yeah.
the, right? Whatever that is, whatever that their thing is, right? Instead of saying, let's say, for example, stop, it hurts, or it's ticklish, or you know, whatnot, you're not doing it right. Just use that word that is equivalent to red. Or instead of checking, am I okay? Are you okay? Is this okay? Are you liking this? Kill the mood. Just use it for green, you know? These are the ones that
Start to
we
have.
need. Exactly.
Yep, that's the consideration, the harmonious piece of it too, is like is being considerate, because it's hard to say, I don't like that, but it's important to also be communicating. So, well, this has been so helpful. Thank you for making the time. Let's see. I wanted to just, I'm going to put this in the information below, like in the caption. But I did want to encourage listeners to check out the book, Love by Design, book.com. It's got a lot of what we talked about today, and it's also got a lot of exercises that you can do in your partnership. And you can also follow her at Dr. Sarah is how we'd say it. Zara Nazar Zara. So I'm going to put that in the comment too, so that the English speaking people can get it right. But thank you so much. Really appreciate this. And I would welcome another conversation about your other book in the future, which is the Orgasm book.
Gosh.
So
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.